What's up? This is Mike Fenoya from Amigos, and Amigos Podcast is In the Loop, the legion of Osiris Podcasts. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with podcasts and live experiences about artists and topics you love. Check out OsirisPod.com and stay in the loop. All right. What's up, folks? Welcome back to Amigos. This is your host, Mike Fenoya. We're here on the Osiris Network. It's November. Veterans Day just went by. I'd like to wish a happy Veterans Day to all of the servicemen and women and family and friends of that are listening. You guys are amazing. You're heroes. And it means so much that you do what you do for us, and I'd like to say thanks on behalf of all of us here at Camp Amigos, because Amigos, as you know, means friend, or friends, plural. I've got an amazing chat today to share with you, part one of a two-parter. Oteil Burbridge is on the pod, and can't wait to share it with you. He's the best, but let's talk biz first, everybody. We'll get that out of the way and then get to an amazing talk with my new good buddy, Oteil. Guys, comedy dates coming up. November 22nd and 23rd, I will be at Syracuse Funny Bone in Syracuse, New York, with my pal Big J Okerson. You can go to bigjcomedy.com or mikefenoya.com for tickets on that. The 26th at 8:30, I will be headlining the Comedy Cellar here in New York City. The Fat Black Pussycat Lounge, doing some new material and getting ready for, I don't know, whatever it may become. It's some of it is in the second trimester, some of it's in the first. Some of it doesn't even know it's a joke yet. It's just a thought in my brain, and I'm going to spill it. So looking forward to it, and that's right before Turkey Day. And then, of course, the Fish Fall Run. And then December 7th, I'm excited for this one, guys. December 7th, I'm going to be at Community Beer Works in Buffalo. It's this really cool brewery slash show space. And I think I'm going to be the second person ever headlining the spot, but I'm doing two shows. I think one at 7:30, one at 10. All the info is at mikefenoya.com, and you could get tickets if you're up in the Buffalo area. I know we've got some listeners up there. I hope you guys can make it out and come hang. Have a beer. We'll make merry, as they say. I'm excited for it, guys. There's a lot of cool stuff happening. As I mentioned, folks, I have a project called Still Chasing. I'm going to postpone the release until after the new year. And I'm very excited about releasing it. I went through with another great Osiris podcast host, a very good friend of mine. He's the host of Across the Margin. He's the host of Welcome to the Party, Pal. And he works on Godwin Evan, Michael Shields. Him and I worked on this together. It's called Still Chasing. It's about why, oh, why am I so addicted to live music? Trey hit it on the head. When we were at Carnegie Hall, he said that live music is the antidote to his perpetual discontent. And man, he couldn't have said it better. But it's a great look back. I share some of my interview with Ken Kesey, talk with Tom Marshall, David Gans, a lot of great people. And I go back and share some old tapes that I recorded on tour in the late 90s. So it's fun to hear me as a kid still doing shows. It's kind of wild, but it's a fun look back. I think I needed it emotionally. And one of the tapes that I recorded was en route to Big Cypress. We're at the 20-year mark from Big Cypress, Phish's Big Millennium Concert. And I want to tell you about a new show from Osiris, After Midnight. It tells the story of Phish's groundbreaking festival on the eve of the new millennium. It was such an incredible time. Phish built a city for 80,000 fans in the Everglades and capped off the festival by playing for 7 hours, ending the concert during sunrise on January 1st, 2000. This 5-episode series includes interviews with band members, Trey Anastasio and John Fishman, fans and crew, and looks back on one of the most unique performances in music history. I was there. It was unbelievable. It was life-changing. Actually, you know what? Here, I'll play part of the trailer for you now.
You're like, with your friends, they're sleeping over, like, we're going to stay up all night. And then, remember, like, if you're a little kid, you're kind of like, well, you can't stay up all night. It's impossible.
We're going to go now to the big Cypress Seminole Indian Reservation in Florida. There was the biggest traffic jam that we know of in the country.
Thousands of people from all across the country all headed to the Everglades to hear the group Phish perform for New Year's.
75,000 people.
75,000 people.
And we couldn't really believe that they were going to play all night. It just didn't even seem possible. Like, how could that even happen?
It happened because for the previous 15 years, the band Phish blazed a fearless and unlikely creative path from deepest Vermont to the Florida Everglades and one of the most legendary performances of all time. It was the year of Woodstock 99.
The crowds are blowing up CO2 tanks from the tractor trailers. They got troops in there with riot gear. They're forcing everybody out.
Mass chaos. Mass chaos.
Some 20,000 attended the first Coachella that October. The Backstreet Boys ruled MTV. Moby topped the music critics' polls and licensed every song on his new album for commercial use. Far, far away from everything, everybody, and everywhere, in Jack Motlow's cow pasture on the Seminole Big Cypress Reservation in Florida, with no sponsorship at all, Phish built a city for 75,000 people, erected surrealistic art installations, and staged a three-day festival with one act and one act only on the bill, and then played a seven-hour-long set that lasted from the final minutes of the 20th century into the literal dawn of the 21st. After midnight, Phish's Big Cypress Festival, a new five-episode podcast from Osiris, is the story of how Phish staged one of the strangest concerts in the history of rock music. My name is Jesse Jarno. Join us as we explore how Phish invented their own telepathic, jam-obsessed musical language, built an independent concert industry, and how both came together in the Florida Everglades for an improvisation-filled performance that landed a 15-foot-long hot dog with headlights in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We'll hear from band members Trey Anastasio.
You know, I think we felt like this party was for our friends.
And John Fishman.
That was the end of a chapter of Phish's life, that and my life.
Former Phish manager John Peluska and others will tell the dramatic, untold story of Phish at Big Cypress.
We had to get some alligator wrangler to pull an 11-foot alligator out of the backstage area. That was interesting. That was a big alligator.
We'll refill the swamp and revisit a legendary independent festival that came to transform the music industry despite being ignored by the mainstream. Phish found someplace better and left behind a map to Big Cypress. After Midnight debuts November 14th on all podcast platforms. Visit osirispod.com/aftermidnight to subscribe today.
If you're out there on the highways, if you're within the sound of our voice, you're near to Big Cypress, Florida.
That's going to be good. I can't wait to hear it. And you guys should go to osirispod.com/aftermidnight, all one word, to subscribe. God, that was such a good time. I can't believe it was 20 years ago. For dates for social media stuff, guys, at AMIGOSPOD, Amigos Pod, at MIKEFINOIA, at Mike Fenoia. That's for Instagram and Twitter. Go to the Facebook Amigos Podcast discussion group. If you're listening on iTunes, give a rating and a review if you haven't yet. Goes a long way. And keep an eye out for a lot of really cool stuff that's happening soon. Also, the Impractical Joker Cruise is coming up. That's a cruise that is a celebration of the TV show that I work on, Impractical Jokers. And my friend Sypha Sounds and I are trying to lose weight for it. And we have a podcast called Lose to the Cruise. You should check that out wherever fine podcasts are listened to. Oteil Burbridge is you know, obviously you guys know him from the Allman Brothers, from Vita Blue, from Colonel Bruce, from Dead and Company, from all of the amazing projects that he's done. I think I first came across Oteil when he was playing with the Allman Brothers, when I first started really rabidly going to concerts and just being blown away by how good he was. And then, you know, he was always in the scene and I was always going to shows and always had such a huge appreciation for him as a musician. And, you know, thanks to the advent of social media, being able to follow along and see this, you know, happy, eyes closed in a trance, playing along with Bobby and Billy and Mickey and Jeff and John Mayer. And it's just, he's just such a cool dude. And I had the privilege, with a little help from my friends, to get to know him and to chat with him while he was in town here in between Dead and Company shows. We got together and we chatted it up, and it just went so natural and so smooth and so fun that, you know, we basically carved out about 40 minutes to talk, and we ended up chatting for like close to 2 hours, and I made a friend out of it. I love this guy, and we've hit it off, and he's a big fan of comedy, and I'm a big fan of his, and I think we're both a big fan of, you know, the importance of happiness and the importance of going for it and forgiving yourself and being aware and silencing all the chatter in the brain and all of it. It's just incredible how all of this really does kind of transcend who you are and what you do and all of that. You know, Oteil's experienced a ton of gain, a ton of loss, a ton of change, and we all do, and we all have, and it was an absolute honor to chat with him, and I'm proud to call him a friend, and I hope he is too. And I am going to share with you part one of a two-parter. It's incredible. I'm really, really happy that I had a chance to chat with Oteil, and I'm very happy to bring you this episode. So I hope you guys enjoy it. Tell your friends, share. And don't forget to check out After Midnight on the Osiris Network. And hats off to everybody at the Osiris team for putting it together. Take it easy, everybody. See you on the other side. Peace.
Hey there, this is Kyle Hollingsworth. You're listening to Amigos with Mike Fenoya on the Osiris Network.
It's cool to hear that you are a stand-up comedy fan. That's neat.
Huge. I mean, you know, I grew up in the era of Richard Pryor and stuff.
Yeah.
So that was just like... it was just mind-blowing, and so ever since then, it's just been one of my main go-tos, you know.
When we were hanging out earlier, you mentioned that there were times that stand-up kind of would save you in a way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I was really super-duper poor living in Atlanta, Georgia, and just experiencing the for-real starving artist trip, you know, I would sometimes go, if I had a little money, I'd go to the comedy club. Pretty sure I probably saw a lot of people that later became famous, but the one that I'm pretty sure of was, I think is he was on TV later. What was his name? Tim the Toolman Taylor or something like that.
Yeah.
'Cause I remember
Tim Allen.
Yeah, that's it.
Tim Allen. 'Cause
he that whole grunting thing, you know, like I remembered that when I was on TV. I was like, hey, I saw him in a comedy club in Atlanta, like before anybody really knew who he was, you know.
He had the grunt. Isn't
yeah,
that weird?
The whole thing was already done back then, you know, and he took it all the way to, you know, network television.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. But,
it really did help me a lot because, you know, when everything just sucks, there's always that. There's always laughter. And that's a pretty sacred thing, you know.
Well, conversely, sitting on the other side of the table, as a comic, struggling and all of that, when you know music is mine, that's my sacred thing. So, I mean, I spend literally every moment that I'm not on stage or traveling at live music, and it's the place where I can go and just stop thinking. Comedy's so weird; it makes your brain. Like, I have a new filter where I can't really sometimes enjoy thoughts. It's like I have to look at them all, like, Did I pick all the meat off this bone?
I never thought about that.
You know? Because we're always looking for new material and things like that.
Yeah, you're screwed for just daily life.
everything is just so frustrating.
And, yeah.
You know. But it does lend itself to finding new ways to like kind of quiet your mind and relax and chill. I go to concerts now totally different than I used to, where I'm more like observing the whole thing and watching the crowd watch you, and that to me is pretty neat.
It's funny because my first and only Grateful Dead show that I ever been to before I got the gig, actually Jerry was still alive, and I remember not so much the band but the whole thing. I was watching the crowd watch the band and the whole dynamic, and you know, for that band, that's like the band to do that with. More than any other band on earth.
It really is.
And it's funny that you say that, because that's exactly how I experienced my first Dead show. You
know? When was that?
Oh, man. It was like, I think Blues Traveler got us in. I was with Aquarium Rescue Unit. Colonel Bruce was still in the band, so it had to be probably 92. Yeah, because we used that first album, Laminate, to get in. So I think it was 92.
Okay.
Around there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was the first time that you got a chance to catch them live?
Yeah. And it's because Popper put us on the list. He's like, man, you guys got to come out. And,
yeah.
And he got us all in. And I didn't really know that much about him, but.
You didn't. That was actually going to be my next question. Were you like a big fan of theirs leading up to that?
No, I got all my friends from when I was really young were Deadheads, you know. And even I can remember now kids in like elementary school whose parents were clearly Deadheads, because I remember the way they dress their kids.
You know, that's amazing. Yeah, totally.
And they were always the sweetest ones too, you know, like the nicest ones out of the whole bunch, you know.
They were the kids in school that had like the stink lines coming off of them like pig
pants. It was just like, you know, all the I probably didn't know what it was back then, but Steely's and, you know, like the handmade clothes or whatever.
Yeah,
you know,
the dancing bears and the whole.
Yeah, patches and stickers.
I think that was the first thing that drew me to them as a kid, was the iconography of it all. Like the Steely, the skeletons and the roses, and it was a weird mystique.
There is so much like do-it-yourself, so much artwork, like, you know, the ticketing envelopes, the stuff that I hear about, you know, from the old days and the way people, there's just so much artwork that the fans created themselves.
Yeah.
Just fully a part of the whole experience. Like it's not just the band.
Well, you have people making artwork of you with them.
I heard yesterday that there's some Oteil acid. Now that was like, what?
Oh man,
it's so mind-blowing, you know what I mean? I was just like, no way. Like, there's some friends that I have to call from high school that were Deadheads, and I need to tell them this, you know, because they're gonna be like, Oteil, you gotta be kidding me. Like, so crazy.
That's gotta be a crazy mind trip to take acid named after you. Like, what do you do? That's got to be such a weird inward.
I mean, I almost feel Mike obligated acid, even though I'm kind of, I don't want to say I'm over it now, but I just am like, I'm in a different space now in my head, you know.
Sure.
I didn't do it at all for a really, really long time. And, you know, my teenage years was when I did most like at 17, 18, a little bit of 19. Mostly 17, 18. And it was those guys that turned me onto it that I need to call. You know, cause they come out to shows. They came out to all my brother's shows. And,
nice.
You know, when I got this gig, they were like, okay, dude, this is crazy. You know how many years we spent trying to get you into the Dead, you know?
And now you're in the
Dead. But I was like, really, I never rejected my parents' music. And they're from here, from the Bronx. So they came up, like, during the Harlem Renaissance.
Oh,
my dad saw, you know, all the great jazz stuff, you know.
You know, that's
as it was happening, you know.
I think that's one of the most fascinating eras in American history, like the Harlem, like W.E.B. Du Bois and Langston Hughes and some of the writing
the
and music
thing,
that came out of it.
The dancers, the writers, the everything. the, you know, all the arts, you know, the music, the.
Well, I believe it was Langston Hughes that said that, like, we're laughing to keep from crying. And I think that, to me, that's something that when you think about comedy or art as a way to heal yourself.
I mean, that's what it's about.
That's when it gets.
That's like why stand-up comedy is sacred. You know, because I mean, it is that, like, it comes out of tragedy, out of the darkness of life, and it's a great thing to learn about life, is that out of that comes the joy. I talk about that all the time, like this, the metaphor of the wine press, like everybody wants the fine wine, but nobody wants to be the grapes getting stepped on to get there.
Oh, wow.
But what's the difference between, what's the best thing that can ever happen to you is like having a baby. And how does that? That's brutal. It'll rip and tear you. I mean, like it's
yeah.
There's nothing more brutal and painful. And then you have the best thing ever after that. So there's like, it's like yin and yang. It has to be balanced out.
I appreciate that.
You know,
yeah.
And you don't get the one without the other, you know.
That's true.
So it's
that's
like,
very true.
Would our music as a black community, would it have that same depth without the oppression, without the, you know?
Yeah, totally.
I mean, the blues, we all have it, you know, it's something everybody can relate to, you know, everybody has to go down.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But it's just all, I don't know.
It's so
like philosophical all of a sudden. But
no,
it's
but
like,
it's true. And it's you think about it, like we're here in Manhattan and it's like right up the road in Harlem. I mean, really the music that got it all started is there. I think about that constantly. I've been listening to so much jazz. I've been on a Sun Ra kick lately too.
Oh,
I've been listening to a ton of. This morning in the shower, I was listening to like the Brighter Side of the Sun and that 79 album with like Space is the Place and all that. And it's just so free.
Yeah.
And it's the music that's free and it comes from such odd, like you said, various pockets in time. And
I mean, think about what that cat went through, because I lived in Birmingham, Alabama for 18 years. That's where he's from. So it was like dropping a space alien off. In Birmingham, Alabama.
Yeah, he really
in like
was.
The worst time, you know, like
yeah.
Just wow. But you know, I got to hang out with him.
Really?
Colonel Bruce, a number of times.
Wow.
And it was life changing, you know. It was life changing.
He's through the music that I love, through the Grateful Dead and through Fish and the Almonds and the stuff that I came up kind of, you know, like the trinity of bands when you're younger. The thing I love about the music I found was it opened up channels to music I never would have experienced before.
Yeah.
And, you know, I knew if the guys in Fish were super into Sun Ra, and I was like, well, if they like it and I like them, I have to give it a shot. And then it was like this whole thing of, and then, you know, Fela Kuti and a lot of other amazing music that, and it's so cool that when you open yourself up to certain genres of music, you get a lifetime's worth of.
Yeah.
It's literally like being handed a library, and now you have all these books to read. That's wonderful about our scene, I think, you know?
Yeah, it is. And I think that's probably why, I was always kind of a renegade or whatever. I mean, I don't mean to say that like in a romantic sense. I was renegade, you know? I just was always going left.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, as a teenager, you know, I'm a black guy that lives in Southeast Washington in the hood, you know, and I was at 13, 14, I started doing classical ballet. You know what I mean? I always was just like another, you know, I was just always going left.
Yeah.
But now when I look back on my life in retrospect, it's like, oh, well, I see how you got here, because it really is kind of that, they have that same mindset that my dad did about music, which is what you were saying. Like, I'm into this. What were they into? What were they into?
Yeah.
And now you're doing a historical exploration and a spiritual one at the same time.
Without a doubt. Yeah.
And I miss that being young, you know, because I was always like into the kind of music that I was into.
Sure,
you know?
Sure, sure.
And I had those kind of blinders on, even though my dad had a really varied music collection, like extensive, all different kinds of music. But like to him, jazz was the pinnacle.
Sure. You know, yeah.
That was the pinnacle.
Did you find yourself as a kid just fascinated by the records, playing with the records, staring at the album covers, things like that?
Oh, I mean, that was our whole life, you know?
Yeah.
My older brother, Kofi, they discovered he had perfect pitch when he was 7. So he raced ahead. Like by the time he was 12, he was just like playing really heavy stuff.
You know? You explain what that means? That they found out that he, like, how does one find out they have perfect pitch?
One finds out by accident sometimes, it turns out, because Kofi had this teacher, I think his name was Mr. Fair, and he's 7, so they gave, there was like, I guess it was a music class or a music part of the class, and he gave them a homework assignment to memorize the notes. So this is where C is, D, E, you know.
Yeah.
And Kofi mistakenly thought that the assignment was to memorize the pitches.
Wow.
So not just to find where C is on a piano, but to know where C is in your mind.
Whoa.
But he could already do that. So it probably wasn't such a far leap for him to make that assumption. Like if you already have the ability to do that, you might think that's what he meant, not realizing as a 7-year-old that almost no one has that ability, including probably the teacher.
Amazing.
And that's not what he was talking about.
Man, that's wild.
So he called, the teacher called my dad and was like, "Hey, do you realize your son has perfect pitch?" And my dad was like, "Man, I knew he was picking up stuff really fast, but I didn't know." It makes sense though, now that you say it, you know? So then, you know, my dad, who's a huge jazz, classical, everything, you know, starts laying the heaviest stuff on my brother, and he's just absorbing it and spitting it back out like it's nothing.
Was it always the flute?
Yeah, and that's because my dad played flute. Kofi really wanted to play keyboards, which is what he ended up doing mostly.
Yeah.
Like when he was 18, he's like, all right, I'm going to buy a keyboard. You know, I'm going to do what I want. You know?
That's great that was the rebellion.
Yeah, for sure, because, you know, he loved the flute, and then it came very naturally to him. He was obviously meant to play it.
Yeah.
But, you know, he loved Herbie Hancock and George Duke and Jan Hammer and Chick Corea and all the, you know, the fusion guys that had played with Miles.
Yeah.
And some, I guess, like, I don't know if George ever played with Miles. He played with Zappa. And,
yeah, he played.
You know. But he was, that was our era, that 70s fusion thing. And that's what he was into, you know.
Did you pick up the bass at an early age and play along with him? Or was it anything before that?
Actually, it was drums. I started playing drums at 5.
Wow. And, what a fun household, sounds like.
Yeah. For people that love music so much, yeah.
Yeah. For the neighbors.
Drums, it's, you know. My mom is a saint. Oh, my gosh. My mom is a total saint. But, it was a very creative household. And, you know, we lived in the hood in Southeast Washington. So they, you know, they were trying to keep us off the streets. So they threw everything at us, like acting, dance, you know.
Yeah.
Painting, whatever, music, like all the above. What are you into?
Yeah.
I mean, and it could be sciences, it could be anything, like, you know, but they were just trying to get our minds
stay focused,
hooked on something that was positive, so we just wouldn't be out running the streets doing bullshit.
What did they do?
My mom was a nurse at DC General Hospital for 30 some years, and my dad was a social worker, like working with juvenile delinquents and stuff, trying to keep them.
Two very compassionate, empathetic people.
Yeah, very much service oriented,
others before self,
for the money, you know. And they could have had money, but they spent it all on, you know, sending us to private school, and, you know, it all went into us.
That's
so they
amazing.
Didn't reap the benefits. They could have had like just a good solid comfortable middle class life, but it was a little harder than that because of the school, but that was their priority, was education for everyone.
That's fantastic. And look where it led, you know. You were taking ballet
crazy and stuff, you know. It's funny because I think it freaked my dad out. I think he was, you know, he's kind of like the old homophobic black guy, you know.
Oh, like, really?
I mean, he's 88. Sure, you know, like, yeah.
Different time, man.
And
totally.
I just realized this, like, recently, like, in the last 10 years, like, you know. But I did it because of, like, I was on the wrestling team then, and I was taking my sisters to ballet class.
Yeah.
And so they're always trying to recruit you. I was like, no. We wear tights. We wear the different tights. They're not wrestling. It's not, you know.
Not getting on your toes.
Yeah, you know, I was not having it.
Wow.
And, but then, so to get out of it, I was like, where's the Coke machine? I need to get out of this office.
Yeah.
You know, they're putting this hard sell on me. And it's downstairs by where the dressing rooms are, where most of the guys were gay, if not all.
Yep.
So the girls are walking around like practically nothing.
Yeah.
And I was like, it was such a jolt for like a 13, 14 year old.
Yeah.
You know,
it was a very pivotal trip to the Coke machine.
Pretty sure I ran back upstairs. I was like, where do I sign up?
I brought my own pen.
Yeah. You know, I was like, I'm in. They're probably like, what?
I'll start today.
Yeah, dude. Where do I get the gear, man?
That's fantastic.
But then
dude,
I actually felt, you know, I mean, we always were really super connected to dance, you know, although it was probably more African dance, Soul Train, that kind of thing.
Sure.
You know,
absolutely.
But, and this was just like the classical European form of it, which I had studied the classical European form of music along with funk and jazz and all that stuff.
Right.
So I had an appreciation for it at the levels that they were coming at me at, you know?
Yeah.
A deep appreciation. I got really, that's what I wanted to do with my life, was be a dancer.
Wow.
You know, I wanted to be with like Alvin Ailey or Dance Theater of Harlem or something.
No kidding.
Yeah, dude, that was what my life path was.
Dude,
and
that's
wild. Got Osgood Slatters, and the doctor said that I couldn't dance and I couldn't do after school sports. And I went into a pretty deep depression and picked up Kofi's electric bass, because like stomping on a bass drum and a hi-hat wasn't going to be good for my knees either.
Really?
And my joints, which is what Osgood Slatters affects, your
sure.
joints. And so
oh man,
the bass was like low impact.
Right.
So I picked up Kofi's bass, and that's how it started, because I couldn't do dance anymore.
Wow.
You know?
So you danced through your fingers.
It was like, and playing drums, you know, like drums and dance. To me, or music and dance, if you're talking classical music, they always go together. And so, yeah, I was able, I feel like I'm playing drums probably as much as dancing on the bass, the way I approach it.
Well, you do. I mean, even like you look back at some of the sessions, like the studio sessions and some of the, like you were saying, YouTube, you watch comedy, I go back and watch music, and I'll get into a wormhole and I'll be watching you and Kofi and Vernon Reed and Derek and everybody playing together. And you do approach the bass in a very unique way. That's what's so fun about
it. Drummer.
It's like really checkerboard. Cool. Like you said, it's every thing. You're doing 10 things. You're not doing one thing. You're doing 10 different digital.
When you're bridging rhythm and harmony, that's the bridge right there for me, is the bass, you know?
Yeah. Oh, it totally is.
Although every harmonic instrument is a bridge between rhythm and harmony, because we're all playing rhythms.
Right.
Like everybody is a drummer, whether they realize it or not, you know?
Yeah.
And they hopefully realize it at some point.
I've always been so jealous of drummers to be able to, and piano players, to be able to do four different things at once with your limbs, to be able to, I played rhythm and sang in a band and it was fun to do. And some people are like, how do you do that? But to me, that was simple. To sit behind a drum kit, I felt literally like I was in someone else's skin. Like I just had no idea how to move. I felt like a puppet with no strings. And
it's hard. They call it independence, like getting independent, you know, your limbs to work together and independently of each other.
You know?
And it's, you just need a certain type of brain.
Yeah.
I guess so. Some people have, you know, people like Vinnie Caliuta, where you're just like, dude, he must have 8 sections to his brain.
I don't understand it. It's unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, really. And Neil Peart. Some of these guys that are just, now let's talk about the two that you're playing with right now.
Yeah.
With these guys, these crazy animals.
Oh my God. Yeah, and, I just got my horns from them. The horning.
Congratulations.
The ancient horning ceremony.
At the garden.
Yes.
How
like,
wild.
Usually this is done in private. I'm like, I'm glad we're doing this in public.
Totally. It'll be definitely scarier with those two horning you.
It's so great. I mean, playing with them is like, you know, it's weird that I had the opportunity to play with like the two biggest rock bands that had two drummers, with the Allman Brothers and the Dead.
Yeah.
And there's no, people ask me like, what's it like? It's like, there's no way to describe it. Like you play with a two drummer pair that has played together since the 60s.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way you can, they're like, well, how do you negotiate between the two drummers? And I always say, I just listen to them as one big drummer.
Oh, wow. You know okay. What I mean? Yeah, totally.
So it's still one drummer. It's just, you know,
it's an octopus.
Yeah. It's just double. And really, when you think of it, like conceptually, it's quadruple and beyond because, you know, each drummer has multiple concepts that they're working with simultaneously, you know?
Yeah. And they totally utilize echo and pitch and delay.
I mean, electronic stuff now and just all kinds of like, they're their whole universe,
yeah.
A whole universe just unto themselves, you know?
Was that overwhelming at first?
No, like I say, I just listen to them as one big drummer. You know, there's a lot of, you have to accept things as they are.
Right.
Yep. You know?
Yep.
So I just deal with it as it is and try and if like the less I think I always say the brain is like the most amazing, you know, intelligence, the most amazing thing. It can process so many things so fast.
Right.
Faster than you can think about it. So if you stop thinking and just let it process it,
yeah,
it'll do it by itself. It's an amazing receptor, you know?
And I think that that's such an underestimated point that you made, that just if you stop and let it happen, and it's the same with relationships, it's the same with comedy, it's the same with anxiety and life, is just...
Yeah.
Quieting, like just you're here
and
now.
Acceptance.
That's the hardest part. I
always
think.
Say, like, my true religion is radical acceptance.
That's beautiful.
You know?
Yeah.
And I.
Just saying yes to the.
You have. Because, I mean, really, what other choice do you have? Well, we have free will, so you do have another choice. But where does that always lead? Like, without fail.
Yeah.
Without fail. And they say if you keep doing that, then they call it insanity.
Right.
So I just, if I can accept Billy and Mickey as it is, accept Butch and J-Mo as it is, you know?
Yeah.
And not even think about it. Like, there shouldn't even be like the point where you have to make a decision. That's already now you've gone off track. You're thinking.
Yeah.
So it's just more like what you're saying, just stop and then just let it come in.
Right.
Just stop.
Yep. Now it's
quiet. You just cut everything off and be a receptor.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you're a conduit. And Jerry talked about that a lot, where he would say, of course the fans can have the notes I played last night because they're not mine anymore. And it was such a neat way of thinking about everything. It's that this moment that we're having here in an hour, it's gone, it's over, but it's something that now the listeners can enjoy. And you think overthink and it doesn't matter. It's just fun. And as long as you're there and you're open to the moment, and what's it like for, when we talk about, like, you went to see a fight, I go see you guys play. Watching you. I'm watching the fans watch you. When you're looking out there and you're looking at the crowd and you're seeing people experiencing the same moment you are.
Yeah.
What's that feeling like for you?
It's weird because a lot of times I get a little jealous. It's always after the fact. It's not during.
Yeah.
But, you know, I saw a video of, we played Chicago, and I think it was the 4th of July.
Yeah.
And then I saw a video of it afterwards, and I was like, oh my God. Like, wow. Like, it's not like that for me. Like, you know, I would hear the crowd cheering all of a sudden, and it might have been some amazing fireworks thing went off, but I can't see. Or they'll start cheering, and I know there's something that went up on the screen behind me. And
right.
Maybe it's a picture of Rob Hunter, or maybe it's a picture of Jerry, or whatever, or Pigpen. Like, I don't, you know, I'm missing it because right. I'm playing looking at them.
Mm.
And I always tell them, like, man, I want to be in the audience just one night. God, if I had a friggin' twin brother that I could just go in the audience one night and let him play the gig, you know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Oh, man.
So, but it's great, though, when I, because times when I am too much in my own head. And I went through that here because I just got back from India, and I just was tired, and we were just starting to settle in at home. And I just wasn't ready to leave.
Yeah.
I was not ready to leave. And I was not up to, my gas tank wasn't full yet. And I had guilt about leaving Jess there alone to do it all by herself. And I went in to sound check, and I still was not feeling it, you know.
Yeah.
But I knew, I was like, once you're on stage and once you open your eyes and look into the audience and see this love and exuberance and just like gratitude and excitement and just pure passion. I mean, it's a sacred thing. And sure enough, man,
it fills your tank.
Boom.
Yeah. Cup runneth over, right?
For real. That stuff's real, man.
It sure is.
It's real. And so I'm always grateful for that. It's like sometimes, you know, I close my eyes when I play a lot. And sometimes, you know, if the critic starts talking, you know, yeah. And it's like, Oteil, open your eyes. Shut the critic up. Just open your eyes. And then you see someone looking at you like, you know.
And then you're like, close your eyes.
And it just puts a knife in the critic's heart.
Sure.
And now he's dead laying on the floor.
Thank God. That's so important to have that. You have to kill the critic.
Yeah. But I mean, I can easily, like, it's just as simple as opening your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I close my eyes, I can get inside my own head.
I've had so many fun moments watching you in your own world on stage.
Yeah.
You're barefoot up there. You got your faces. Your wife paints your face.
Yeah,
she does
we
a beautiful
did that last
job.
Summer.
Yeah, that was so cool, man. And you're just up there having such a good time.
That's the good side of the coin of being in your own head. Like when your eyes are closed and you're just off, you know, crossing dimensions.
Yeah.
And just within the dimension of joy, you know, and that's the good side of it, you know. And then you don't have to open your eyes.
What does your inner critic criticize?
Everything.
Everything.
Every last moment that just went by.
Really?
Like, I a long time ago when I was doing the trio with Kreutzmann.
Mm.
I mean, he would microdose most nights, and I wasn't doing any at all at that point. This was a long time ago. And so finally one night, I just was like, I had to ask. I was like, because he was not young back then, you know?
No, I know.
And I didn't realize he was microdosing. I thought he was just like doing a hit or two of acid every night, you know? So I was like, dude, how do you do that like every night? That's like why? And without barely a millisecond passing, he said, because it silences the critic. And I went, damn, that is such a great answer.
It silences the critic.
You know? And that's a convenience. It's a convenient way to do it, but it's a pretty surefire.
It's
he just wants to let every last moment be in the past. If you spent a fraction of a millisecond thinking about the fraction of the millisecond that just passed, now you're not in the flow anymore.
Yep.
And the thing is to be in the flow. You don't need LSD or mushrooms or anything to do that, you know?
No.
But I get it.
I do too.
I get it, man.
Yeah.
I really do get it.
Yeah.
And I can't argue with it.
Nor would
especially
I.
Especially if you're microdosing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I like a small amount of mushrooms to do that, to help me be more just appreciative. I find that I'm not appreciating things as much as I would like to. Because of, it's like I'm it's like that critic when you take away his typewriter. Or you take away his it's like, where do I write this down? Like, and it's almost like looking for something to criticize. And then when you finally take away, you know, you put a blinder on him. It's like, just chill out, man. Like, we got this.
Isn't it such a weird thing? Like, our minds and spirits.
Yeah.
Like it's and brains. Because I'm not sure that the mind and the brain is the same thing. I feel like they're different.
I agree with you.
But,
yeah.
You know, like, it's such a hard thing to negotiate, this free will thing. It's so hard to negotiate. Like, people say, oh, Teal's such a nice guy. And, you know, like, my observation about myself here recently, my biggest one is, like, in an airport, especially in New York, you know, a subway, where there's more of a crowd.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
The horrible shit that my brain is saying, or what I'm thinking on the inside, just totally judging people.
Yep.
Like, just, I'm like, God, O'Teal, like, man, stop.
Yep.
Like, what are you doing? Like, I just, like, I have to talk to myself.
You're preaching
like
to the choir,
you have the good angel and the bad angel on the other side, you know, which is great for stand-up comedy, because now you can let both of them just duke it out and just write it down.
That's
you know
it,
what
man,
I mean?
Totally.
But it's like not people's perception of me is not what I am. Like I'm horrified at who I am on the inside, especially lately. Just like what I was thinking on the airport on the way here, I was like, wow, Teal, you need to reel it in, bro.
I guess it's the self-awareness that you acknowledge it is the important part. I think that's what keeps you from being, that's the good part.
So then
that's the
this
good
is
part.
Good. That means
this is
growth.
Cathartic, man. Totally.
Yeah, because you're checking yourself out and being like, dude, that's fucked up.
Right.
Like, wow.
And if you think
you're
about it.
You're not a good person.
If you were.
You're not a good person?
You were an asshole, man.
I mean, if people heard what I was, if I just spoke it.
But you're not alone.
You know what I mean? Like,
I think that's what's important is you're not alone. And if you were walking around going, everyone's beautiful in the airport. You'd be batshit crazy,
but
dude.
I mean, like, you
the
know,
airport's a terrible place.
It's like this lesson I've been learning a lot, and I think God, the universe, whatever you want to call it.
Yep,
I'm a believer in the mystical. But it's been showing me how I misjudge people. So the person that I'm like. And I don't know why I feel that way about a person, but I feel it, and it's an aversion. And maybe I can pick certain things out, you know, if I, like, really analyze it. And I feel okay with that because I feel like we should feel things out.
Sure.
But really, many times lately when I've had this aversion or whatever, and then I find out, that person was not at all like what I thought, you know?
Yeah, totally. I hear what you're saying.
And it happened to me here at the hotel. I was coming down and you know, automatically I just got off the elevator, you know, and I'm walking down the hallway and I see this guy and that same dude that was in the airport. Look at this motherfucker. Like, you know, but I'm just like, God, O'Teal, here we go again.
Yeah,
you know?
Totally, dude.
And then I get past him. And he's like, he sees me. He's like, oh, dude, I really loved your last two shows. And he stuck his hand. I shook his hand. He was like the warmest guy. You know,
and you don't,
like,
even really
see that you had no evidence even to go on. It's just like the asshole in there. Just all he needs is just to see anything and just start.
Look at this idiot. Yeah.
I just, like, God, O'Teal, man.
Dude, I've been working on a long chunk of material called React and Regret, because that's literally like I just live my life reacting. And then the moment that my reaction comes out, I'm like, you fucking dick.
You dick.
You piece of shit. Like, I'm a dick. But I swear, I think that it's something with us that, like, we're so critical of moments because we have to provide these moments for certain for people. You know what I mean? Like, if you're in front of a crowd,
yeah,
right? So you become hyper analytical, and it's hard to shut that off. And then you see, so I was coming here on the subway, and a woman squeaked by the back of another woman to sit before she sat.
Oh, just.
And I was boring a hole in the side of her. I'm like, look up at me. Please fucking look up at me. I just want you to see the disgust that I have. And this little voice is like, Mike, why are you letting this even affect you? But it's so fun when you're in the moment.
It's true. I mean,
it's weird.
It is weird, man.
But at least you're not yelling it out. That's the important part, you know? You're quieting it before.
But a couple times, like, I've had to apologize for things. I apologized to an Uber driver recently.
Yeah.
And I was just stressed out. We were going to India to go get Kabi, finally, you know, the little girl that we just adopted.
Yeah.
And it took 2 years. And I was super stressed out. This Nigel was not going with us. Really stressed that this was going to be the longest time Jess had been away from him.
Mm-hmm.
The longest time I've been away from him, I'm pretty sure. I usually keep it to 2 weeks. And so I just was rude to the Uber driver, you know? And he's an old guy that just... And so when I tipped him, you know, like after your... Yeah. I use Lyft. So after they leave, you get a thing where you can tip him and you can also write a comment. So I wrote him a note. Hey, man, I'm sorry. And I just explained, like... We're going to India, but it's short. But I just was like, I was not being nice, and I apologize.
That's nice of you.
So I have the rare time that, you know, my stress gets the better of me, and I do actually say it, and I'm not just sitting in the airport, fine, but just thinking fucked up shit,
grumbling into a coffee
cup.
Yeah,
you know, for no reason. So
congratulations on everything with the adoption.
Oh, thank you.
That's really awesome, man. 2 year process.
I tell you what, imagine being pregnant for 2 years.
No.
You know what I mean? It's like, it's a mind.
It
messes with your mind.
To see the pictures that you guys posted up, and just to, like, experience, you know, your new child. This is a new part of the family, and the experience must have just been so surreal.
Top to bottom. I mean... Boy, we could do a whole podcast just on that, but there's a couple of things that really stick out. One is that, you know, the process took so long, and we had heard, my wife was really smart, and she followed and even maintained contact with other people that had adopted from India.
Mm-hmm.
And so we knew it could take a long time, but... We got matched with her a year and a half ago. So, in theory, it probably could have taken 4, 5, 6 months.
Yeah.
Maybe. Like, best case scenario.
Yeah.
But it didn't, and it dragged on, but it still wasn't like it didn't take 3 years.
You know, yeah, it could have been way worse. That,
yeah.
Yeah.
That it's gone worse. And then some real horror stories where it just blew up after a long time, you know. But then you still have to deal with, you know, they send you pictures and videos. And then you get a picture and you're like, oh, wow, her teeth are coming in. Is that 2 teeth I see?
Oh, wow.
And so then you have this agony of, like, she's teething, which is a really super hard part of being a baby, you know.
Yeah.
It's so painful.
Mm.
And you need to be comforted somehow. You just dribble all over yourself all the time, you know.
And you want
to
be there so bad.
It's just so much pain.
Yeah.
And nobody's comforting her. Mm. Because there's 50 or 60 other kids.
Oh, God.
And who knows how many of them are teething. And you're like, and then we're like, wow, she's got 5 teeth. This is good, but now my heart's breaking.
Yeah.
I can see my wife's heart breaking. You get the video. and she's walking. Now I missed her first steps. I wasn't there for her when she was teething. You know, you find, oh, she got pneumonia four times.
Oh, God.
I wasn't there for her. We didn't even find out till after the fact, you know?
Yeah.
And her getting pneumonia, that state could kill her.
Right.
Like, so now we're like, okay, we got to get her out of there because if she gets pneumonia again, she could die.
Yeah.
So now this has taken too long. Jeez. Like, I mean, it's a real, it just messes with your mind so much.
And meanwhile, you're on stage, you're playing, you're traveling, you're, I mean, it's got to be a very hard balance to.
Well, it's a lesson in acceptance and radical acceptance because, you know, it's another country. Like, you know, when you travel to other countries, you better keep your entitled guy that gets easily frustrated when shit doesn't go his way guy. Like, you need to put that guy in jail.
Yeah, you got
to
duct tape him.
Yeah, and duct tape his mouth.
Right, totally.
You have no rights
in
someone else's country. You're sitting there in immigration. Don't get an attitude, man. Like, you know, so when you're dealing country to country, you just can't, you know, you can't pull that entitled American bullshit.
Right.
You know?
And that first moment you were able to when the I's were dotted and the T's were crossed and you were able to bring her with you.
Yeah.
Well,
it was difficult for Kavi. Thank God she is as resilient as she is because we had intended to go for one of the court dates. Because if their parents are there, they're more likely to approve you. That's like the last thing. You need that court decree, the verbal decree and the written decree. Wow. And then it's like, she's yours. You can take her out of the orphanage and nobody can make you give her up. She's your daughter.
Wow.
Well, the judge missed like 7 court dates. And what we didn't know until the last court date when we flew Anu back to Allahabad, which is where Kavi was, to go, because they were like, if you should come, it'll probably go smoother. And we were like, the judge missed 7 court dates. Like, we're not flying all the way over there for them to just not even show up.
My God.
So Anu got there. Everybody was on strike.
On strike.
So I was like, well, that explains why the judge would miss the court date. And then we'd be like, well, when are they coming back? And we're like, we don't know. But because a strike doesn't just happen overnight.
Yeah, it doesn't have an end.
So I was like, well, that's why it took a year and a half. Okay, oh, so man. That's explained now. So Anu just begged, you know. She knows judges and the woman's a saint. Like, I need to do a post on social media just about her because
and
without her, none of this, she might, Kavi would probably still be there.
Really?
You know, so she got it done. And then, so we didn't get to like meet her and then spend some time with her and then take her out. So we ended up, and we sent Jess made this whole book, like, this is your family, for the caregivers to show her so she could see our faces.
I saw
the
that.
Book never made it there.
Oh, so geez.
It's still sitting in a FedEx office in some other part of India. Yeah.
The art of acceptance, huh?
You have to, man, just be I'm able telling to. You, boy, you better, that you have no choice.
That's it.
You're just screaming at a wall.
There's so much that's out of our control.
Yeah. So when we finally did go, we ended up taking her out of the orphanage the first day that she met us. She didn't know what we looked like. She had no idea who we are. Doesn't want any part of us at all. And screamed bloody murder when we were taking her out. Fortunately, I think it was close to her nap time, and she kind of tired herself out crying and fell asleep on Jess in the car.
Mm.
And but she wanted no part of us, you know. And when she woke up, she was like, oh, my God, it's you two again. Who are y'all? And where are we? Like, I don't know where I am. And she was freaking out. And you just feel so bad because you know you're there to rescue her.
Yeah.
She doesn't know how bad she has it. That's just home.
It's reality.
That's her reality, and it's not good or bad. It just is what it is.
Exactly. At that age.
They're masters of radical acceptance. Yeah. They're just checking out what is.
You're completely at the disposal of whatever life is handing you at the time.
Yeah, so she doesn't have any judgments about it, you know. And But she had a judgment about us. She was like, yeah, I want to go back home.
Yeah.
So we were terrified because we expected this. Like, you know, we've read all the stories and whatever. But it's still, it hurts because you hurt for her. But our main concern was, can we get her to eat?
Mm.
Because she wouldn't take food from us. She didn't want any part of us, you know?
Wow.
And, there's a moment that I got a picture of it, and it's posted on Instagram, where the next day, we took her down to breakfast, and Jess is holding her, and she's just looking up at Jess, and Jess is looking at her, and Kavi's just looking inside of Jess, like probing her spirit, and I saw it, and I went, oh man, I pulled my phone out and took a picture of it.
Mm.
And Jess passed the test, and then she started taking food from her.
Wow.
And I was like, man, that's the deepest, aside from the birth of my son, like, that's one. Because if you have a child, you can't imagine your kid rejecting you. It's your child. Like, you know, there's the automatic...
Good, bad, and different.
Well, they need you. They're exactly. Like, you know, yeah. Pick me up, like whatever. Yeah. But this is like, you have to.
It's so much harder.
You have to allow them to.
Yeah.
Accept you. Like, it's another thing. And it didn't happen for me.
And she hasn't probed this.
Scream if I looked at her. Like, literally, if I looked at her, she would start just bawling.
Oh, my God, dude.
But I didn't care because. As long as she had bonded with Jess and she was eating,
yeah,
and pooping regularly, like we're yeah. In the flow now.
Sure, totally.
So I'll sit back here and I'll
when the watch time is right,
YouTube's and Netflix or whatever.
Yep,
you know.
Oh man,
but it was a miracle watching that happen between her and Jess and their whole relationship. And we've had a number of other breakthroughs with me and Kavi that. They're long stories, but they're it's just...
That's beautiful stuff, man.
It's really the most beautiful stuff. Like,
yeah.
My kids are like the true magic, best movies, best comedy, best everything.
Best everything.
You know?
Yeah. Like, so when you're up there and you're on stage and you're playing, do you have them in your mind? Are you thinking about them? Or do you kind of get lost in the music? Or
I always, you know... I'd like to say yeah, but I try to get everything out of my mind.
Sure, I could see things being distracting.
It's more like they're in my intention. You know, like I'm not playing just for whatever now.
Mm.
Like I'm playing for them. So in that sense, they're always not the forefront of my mind, but they're the foundation of the whole thing.
Got it.
Yeah. And my wife Jess too. You know, it's like it's just the family. I'm playing to be their foundation that their house is built on, their security. You know.
Yeah. There's purpose.
Yeah. Yeah. Serious, much more purpose in it, which helps me get out of my mind better. You mm-hmm. know.
Yeah.
I have a. More reason to, and I think a better ability to comes with that.
Yeah.
Also.
Do you remember you know? When Adrian was in the hospital bed in Rocky and she opens up her eyes and goes, when? And then what are we waiting for? I think about that all the time with my wife too. That I mean, like she's someone who, I mean, we live separate for our careers.
Yeah.
So I'm down here. She's
wow.
Lives in New England and she's a nurse and I do comedy and write. And
wow.
So we have a thing where the distance between us is the sacrifice and yeah. the challenge. But also we both know we need that in order to
right now for what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of like we know that the marathon is worth the tough sprint.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's man. You're
having
wise.
A powerful woman in your life is the most important thing in the world.
Man, it really is. Like, you know, my days when I didn't want to settle down, what folly. Oh, man. Yeah. Because the strength that I get from Jess is...
You guys seem to have a super cool...
We're just like everybody else. We go through our stuff, but
who doesn't?
Changed yeah. my life completely. because when I was finally able to accept, you know, I have this song called Chasing, and it's basically after, you know, a person that's constantly chasing after stuff that they already have. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So it's like when you realize, hey, you've got this incredibly beautiful, smart, talented wife that actually can put up with your ass and yeah. thinks you're worth putting up with your ass for, is being your foundation, you know, my source of encouragement, my source of, you know, telling me what I don't want to hear.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I always tried to tell that to my brother before he passed away. Like, man, and I'd say it to anyone, man or woman, you know, if you find someone that you love, that loves you like that, and you can let them tell you the things that you don't want to hear, that's the best thing you'll ever find.
Yeah.
Besides your kids, which come after that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
But you have to have that source of correction that you don't want to hear about yourself. Nobody wants to hear that shit. I know she's right. You know what I mean? I know she is.
I brought my wife to see me do stand up when we were dating, and it was like I was very new in it. And I brought her, and I got into it with the crowd, and the crowd chewed me up and spit me out. And I was up there, my tail between my legs, and I knew that she was the only person I cared about in the room.
Yeah.
And I had to walk over to her, and I was like, that went okay, right? And she goes, are you any good at this? She goes, that's the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. And she chewed me up. She told me every single thing I did wrong, and I fell deeper in love with her at that moment.
Wow.
Then I was like, I'm marrying her. I can't.
Wow. Gratuity. See, men never do that.
But dude, gratuity is the most apathetic. Like, I can't stand that, like, oh, you did good. No, we all know that was awful.
Yeah.
And she literally threw it right at me, and I'm like, this is the one.
Wow.
Yeah.
Guys
just
never do that.
I had to do it.
You're a unique.
Well, dude, man. You know,
maybe
it's
that's
acceptance.
Where you were at that point in your life too.
I think I was.
Yeah,
I think I totally was. Yeah. No, but it was wild. but and we're still plugging together. You know, we're still doing it.
Adios, amigos.